Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here as we're into near the middle of October 2019. Definitely starting to feel like fall out there with some snow levels down to look like around 2,200 feet or so here around Sitka this weekend. And it's always nice to see that fresh snow on the mountains here. It's one of my favorite times of year for scenery. I want to get right to the conversation I have for this week's show. This past week, I was able to see a presentation by John Harley of the Alaska Coastal Rainforest Center. He's collaborating with the Sitka Tribe of Alaska's Southeast Alaska Tribal Ocean Research, CTOR, laboratory, looking at ways to try and model harmful algal blooms and when there's a good chance that one of those will occur. I had a chance to visit with him this past Friday during his trip here. And so we'll go ahead and join the conversation with him, talking a little bit about what's motivating his work.
The state of Alaska does not have a state-sponsored shellfish monitoring program, whereas states like Washington and Oregon and even British Columbia, they do have a state-sponsored program. And so your options for kind of trying to determine if your shellfish are safe or not are really, you can either go out and test them yourself. You can send them into DEC, or now you can send them here in Sitka to the Sitka Tribe of Alaska. It would be really interesting if we could actually use data and variables that are already being collected by satellites and by stream gauges and by weather stations. If we could use those data to try to predict when these blooms are going to happen, and that will be able to help us figure out kind of when and where these blooms might occur and when and where the shellfish might be toxic.
So it turns out that there is a lot of data available, mostly in the form of, satellite sensors, but also buoys and various other kind of weather and climate sensing and oceanographic sensing sorts of things. And so you have an immense amount of data. Of course, in order to predict it, you also have to have the data that is like, okay, so here's our data we'd like to use to predict, and here's what we're trying to predict. So you need that data, which is a little sparser, and that's basically been collected over the last few years, maybe only two or three years now, through the Sitka Tribe Environmental Laboratory and their ongoing monitoring, which they have partners throughout Southeast, as I understand. And so you're using that data, and that's why you're working with them to say, okay, now I have all this predictive, all these things we hope are predictive, and here's the actual data that we're measuring for what we're interested in. You know, how are these related?
Yeah, that's right. So there's a tribal partnership called the Southeast Alaska Tribal Ocean Research, or CDER group. And there's about 15, it might actually be more now, they keep adding communities, which is great. But there's about 15 participants that send either biweekly or once a month shellfish samples to the lab here in Sitka at the Sitka Tribe of Alaska. And the Sitka Tribe analyzes the shellfish for toxins, and then they put those data online. And they've been doing that since about 2015 or early 2016. So yeah, we have almost three full years worth of data at this point. But you're right, it is pretty sparse. We know that people are harvesting shellfish in Alaska, and they've been doing so for hundreds of years. And there were some very high profile cases of PSP, paralytic shellfish poisoning, that have occurred in humans. And a lot of those cases have been here in Southeast Alaska. But unfortunately, up until about 2015, when this CDER program started, we didn't have a regular monitoring program. And so we know that there were toxic shellfish, but we didn't know kind of when and where these blooms were occurring. And we didn't have any idea kind of if we could predict these blooms and when the shellfish were going to be hot.
Yeah, and I know that you're working with the Alaska Coastal Rainforest Center out of Juneau, and in partnership with the CTOR here. And so I don't know if you know the answer to this, but just you did mention that folks can send in samples. So I've previously spoken with, I think, Chris Whitehead and Esther Kennedy, who are working with the lab. They mentioned that if you are planning to go harvest, you know, go out a day or two before, harvest something, just pick a couple, find a couple and bring them into the lab, and they can turn them around in that time frame. And I can't remember what they charged. I think at the time it might have been $50 or something like that, and I don't know what it might be now. But that sounds like that program is still in place.
Yeah, and you can find the current information on the cedar.org, SEATOR.org. And they have a link there and a form that you can fill out if you want to submit a shellfish sample. And I don't know the exact price, what they're charging right now for that analysis. But they do a really good job of turning around the data very quickly. Usually it's within 1 or 2 days of them receiving the sample. They can tell you what the concentrations of PSP are in that shellfish.
And so as a practical matter, then the let's see if I can sort of offer what I remember vaguely of how this works. Like there's a couple of different, you know, you're mostly focused on the Alexandrium.
That's right,
yeah. Which is a particular kind of plankton, dinoflagellate, that, well, what was new to me in hearing in your talk was that it isn't just one toxin, but it's actually a whole host of toxins that have a very similar effect in practice. So unless you are actually looking at it, you know, you just assume maybe it was all the simple case is that it's all one toxin, but it turns out that that's part of what makes it difficult is because it isn't. And you had mentioned that in the case where there's just one toxin and there are other kind of shellfish poisonings, I guess, toxins that are, created by these algae that the shellfish can then accumulate, which are relatively easy to see in the field, to test in the field, but paralytic shellfish poisoning is an exception to that.
Yeah, that's right. There's a number of toxins that are produced by phytoplankton. These paralytic shellfish toxins are kind of one group of toxins, but there's others like domoic acid and ciguatera. Ciguatera is thought of as more of a tropical toxin. It's also produced by a dinoflagellate similar to Alexandrium. But it exists kind of in more tropical waters. So there are some cases in Hawaii pretty often and kind of other areas where you have these reef fish that accumulate high concentrations of ciguatera. And the ciguatera toxin is a single molecule. We know the structure very well. And so we can design these relatively simple assays that you can actually take out in the field with you. And you can do a check to see if the fish has a high concentration of ciguatera. And they work pretty well. They're not, 100% bulletproof, but they work pretty well. The problem with paralytic shellfish toxins is that it's not just one toxin. It's actually upwards of 24 different chemicals, and they all kind of have the same mechanism of action. They all block your cell's ability to essentially transmit electricity or to transmit a current. They sit on these proteins called sodium channel receptors, and they stop your nerves from firing, essentially. And so all of these different toxins, all 25 of them basically do the same thing, but they all look slightly different. And so it makes it really hard to design a simple and effective tool that you can take out into the field with you that could check for these toxins. Because usually those tools are based on having a single chemical, a single structure. This one happens to be several dozen.
Mm. Yeah, which I guess is part of what makes it interesting, but challenging all the same. So I guess the overall pattern of algae and algae blooms is pretty straightforward. It has to be light and at sufficient temperature, and then they grow. Of course, then it gets more complicated because there's other things growing and eating them, and there's this whole dynamic that's going on. And so part of I guess the monitoring that's taking place is actually taking place year round. It isn't just in the seasons where there's expected to be potential for blooms. Is there a reason for monitoring year round, or is that could there be blooms in the winter, or is it just it's good practice to be kind of, and I guess they're monitoring different species, and so some species hold on to it longer than others. Maybe that's part of it as well.
Yeah, that's right. So there is a definite difference between different species that people are consuming. For most of my modeling work, I've used blue mussels, which are a species that might not be the most delicious, but they make really good modelers because they uptake the toxin really quickly and then they excrete it really quickly. And so you can be pretty sure that if a blue mussel has a high toxin concentration, that a bloom is actively occurring. Whereas something like a butter clam might actually take up that toxin a little bit slower, but they'll hold on to it for quite a while. So butter clams have been known to hold on to the paralytic shellfish toxins for months or even years following a bloom of Alexandrium. But another reason that we monitor both during the summer when these blooms are known to happen and the winter when we typically don't see blooms. There's a couple of reasons for that. One is that in terms of modeling, it's important to know what causes a bloom and then also what doesn't cause a bloom, because these blooms kind of occur they're in very short time scales. And so it's really useful to know, okay, these are the conditions that can lead to a bloom, but if we see those conditions and a bloom doesn't happen, we need to know why that occurs as well. So we do monitor blue mussels year-round. We also monitor the butter clams year-round in most communities so that people will know if the concentrations increased over the summer, that they've dropped down to below safe levels, hopefully during the wintertime or early spring.
Yeah, that makes sense. And the so the blue mussels are taking in the stuff. They're processing a lot of water, essentially, and so filtering quickly, passing stuff through quickly. And you get these spikes. You said that the blooms happen over a relatively short period of time. I guess, is that because the algae are reproducing that quickly or coming out of the I know that they have this sort of, I don't know if dormant's the right word, but this cyst form that they can await for good conditions, or maybe it's a combination of both.
Yeah, it's the actual kind of trigger, the actual, you know, spark that starts a bloom, it can be different in different places at different times. But there are, Alexandrium does have these resting cysts that settle out into the sediment, and then they can be resuspended or kind of triggered to become active again by certain environmental conditions. You can also have a bloom that started by, you know, maybe there was a small bloom of Alexandrium happening somewhere in a different bay, and then the current kind of brought it down, and then it started to bloom in a new area. But the blooms can happen very fast. You can think of these thousands of cells existing in the water, and they have a pretty fast reproductive rate. And so if you think about kind of a cell just dividing and dividing and dividing, you can end up getting really kind of almost exponential growth rates. And then eventually it starts being limited by there's not enough nutrients, or they're competing with each other, or they're being grazed upon by some sort of zooplankton or crustacean. And so then the bloom kind of has this terminus, but to go from a relatively small concentration to a large concentration of Alexandrium cells can happen within a matter of days.
Okay, so I'm reminded of, you know, it's a different kind of organism, to be sure. It's a plankton still, but the coccolithophores that are so visible when they bloom, I imagine they're there pretty routinely in small numbers, but when they really get going, you know, they turn the color of the water that color. And I think somebody was talking about actually diving underneath them and how, like, they actually are absorbing a lot of the light in that upper layer, and so it gets pretty dark and underneath them. But there, and thinking about the blooms I've seen of those around Sitka, it seems like you know, usually maybe a week or so, like, that starts to show up, and then it's kind of intense for a while. And then I don't know if it's coincidental or if it's a factor, but it seems like it rains or something, and then it kind of clears out. And maybe that's just coincidental for what I'm looking, or maybe the runoff is having something to do with sort of flushing things out and making the conditions not conducive for those to persist. But so that's the kind of window we're looking at, is maybe a the full sort of sequence ramp up and ramp down is maybe a week long for these blooms.
Yeah, that's probably a good guess. And the coccolithophores and other phytoplankton that have kind of these bloom characteristics, they really like the water column to be very well stratified. So stratification is sort of the separation of really warm surface water with colder water. And so these coccolithophores, they really, when they're under a bloom, the stratification or the mixed layer is usually very deep, which means they have pretty warm upper surface water. And that usually occurs when the weather is very warm. There's not a lot of wind, usually not a lot of rain. And so those usually see after a period of a couple of, you know, pretty hot sunny days with no wind, everything's pretty still. And the end of the bloom, or sort of when they get blown out, is often triggered by a storm. So the wind will come in and mix everything up, and they'll get pushed down into lower water where they can't photosynthesize, or, you know, runoff will come in and create a freshwater lens and kind of create some turbulent mixing. But these, the blooms typically occur when things are really calm and still, so that the phytoplankton can reproduce without having to worry about being sent down into deeper water or being sloshed around by waves. And so something like a large storm or a big precipitation event will definitely clear out blooms in a lot of areas.
Yeah, okay. So that it isn't necessarily just coincidental that it seems that way, which I guess makes sense. And I mean, we've talked about two species that are blooming here, but I guess probably in general, I remember you know, past guest on the show that I spoke with and gave a talk here was from Ketchikan Bay area, and was just talking about monitoring plankton in Ketchikan Bay, and that it was relatively new. I think they'd been doing it for 2 years, and it was clear that there wasn't really, like, normal wasn't really normal. Normal was different things happening all the time, sort of thing, and that there were spikes of different groups of species, I think, they were looking at. So I don't really have a sense, and maybe you don't either, but of how many different possible things are blooming. But most of them, I'm guessing, don't have toxic components like the Alexandrium does. And I suppose that's probably, like, they're probably in competition with each other, and that probably is a complicating factor. Like, the conditions that might be great for something to bloom, it isn't always going to be Alexandrium, even though sometimes it might be.
Yeah, that's right. You know, there's thousands, and that's probably a low estimate, but there's definitely at least thousands of different species of phytoplankton that are existing in the water, even just here off of Sitka, even just off the dock of the Sitka Tribe of Alaska building. And some of them are blooming sometimes, some of them are blooming at other times, and it can be really difficult to predict which ones are going to be kind of the big bloomers. We do know a little bit about you know, which kind of groups tend to bloom when. In the springtime, we usually see diatoms bloom before the dinoflagellates. But, you know, during the late spring and early summer, there's blooms of different species that are happening at all times. And it can be really difficult to predict which ones of those are going to bloom. It can be that once you start seeing these blooms of dinoflagellates, that nutrients, the nutrients in the water actually kind of become a limiting factor for these algal blooms. And so you have these nitrogen and phosphorus and these nutrients that are floating around in the water, and they get taken up by these organisms, and now all of a sudden they're not available to other organisms. And so that can be kind of a limiting factor for further bloom formation during the summertime. But you know, if you have a big storm event that mixes up the water again, if you have a bunch of precipitation that flushes out a bunch of organic material from the terrestrial ecosystem, you can easily trigger another bloom, especially in areas that are heavily forested with really, really flashy watersheds like Southeast Alaska.
So when these things are dying, I guess, I mean, some of them are clearly food for zooplankton. And the zooplankton in turn are creating waste products and that sort of thing. So I would imagine there's some sort of cycling, but maybe most of them, as they die, instead of sort of being recycled at the surface, they tend to sink down. And so maybe that ends up being a nutrient. Like they aren't recycling those nutrients in a usable form for phytoplankton. Other things will no doubt use them as they sink down. But is that kind of what's going on? Is that a lot of those, as they bloom, those nutrients are kind of lost to the surface do they sink? Is that kind of what's going on?
Yeah, a lot of them will sink and kind of settle out into the sediment. And you know, you said earlier about, you know, there's not a lot of species of phytoplankton that are harmful or produce toxins. And that's true. Most of them don't produce toxins, at least things that are toxic to fish and humans. But one of the concerns about these large algal blooms is that when these algae do eventually sink and settle out into the sediment, and they start to decay or decompose, they actually, you know, the bacteria and the microbes that are doing the decomposition are consuming oxygen. And so they can actually create these large anoxic zones, especially around mouths of rivers that are putting out a bunch of nutrients. They can create these large anoxic zones, which means there's not enough oxygen in the water. And that can actually lead to fish kills, massive die-offs of fish that happen to live there or swimming through, and all of a sudden there's not enough oxygen running past their gills, and they can actually suffocate.
So I've heard about that, especially as regards to the Gulf of Mexico, that where the Mississippi River drains out, especially once the increase of farming and farm fertilizer runoff essentially is this massive fertilizer bloom in the Gulf there and creating these big dead zones. But it seems like I've also heard about that occurring from time to time off the coast of Oregon and impacting like crab fisheries, for example, bottom fisheries.
Yeah, there's the dead zone that's in the Gulf of Mexico, kind of at the Mississippi Delta, is a very, very well-known and kind of well-studied area. And it seems that it's very much exacerbated by this huge influx of nutrients that's happened since, you know, kind of industrial revolution days, when we started doing massive industrial scale farming along the Mississippi River or in that watershed. So a lot of the nutrients that people are using for fertilizers for their fields and their farms end up flushing into the Mississippi River and then go out into the ocean, which creates massive algal blooms, especially during the early spring. But yeah, once those algae die and fall out of the water column into the sediment, they start decomposing, consuming the oxygen, and creates these massive hypoxic zones, or dead zones, as they call them. But these actually occur naturally. There are dead zones that occur just kind of in places that don't necessarily have a high agricultural input or high nutrient input from humans. And it's a similar mechanism. You know, you have an algae bloom and, the algae can settle out, start to decompose, and then consume the oxygen in that area. So there are dead zones that we know about that probably aren't as influenced by humans. It can definitely affect, fisheries. It can definitely affect, the survivorship of different species.
Mm. So you were mentioning that throughout the summer, there's different things. There's probably always something blooming, and I guess that's one of the things. As I was looking at your graphs and stuff during your talk, what you were really tracking was blooms of Alexandrium, so one particular species group or genus, I guess, which maybe includes multiple species in practice, and that these were, you know, so they had they were often showing a spike in the spring and then maybe a lesser spike, but a spike still in the fall. As the temperatures were still warm enough, but now we had more nutrients coming in, maybe less predators as well. And then, but in between those times, there's just the different cycles of different things blooming. Or is it still considered a bloom if there's just a lot of diversity? Like, are blooms pretty much limited to being like species or group specific, or is it just a general bloom when a lot of things are going, but nothing in particular is dominating?
Yeah, so the idea of a bloom is a little bit subjective. We often kind of use these classification categories for talking about how many of a particular species are in the water. And usually when we talk about a bloom, we're talking about one particular species. And especially if we're talking about a harmful algal bloom, it's almost always a single species, although there can be two species of harmful algae that are blooming at the same time. But yeah, there's always phytoplankton in the water. And so even when we do nettoes, you know, in the middle of winter and the water's, you know, 41 degrees, you can find phytoplankton in there. And some species do a lot better at lower water temperatures. Alexandrium happens to be a species that requires kind of warmer temperatures in order to reproduce, in order to bloom. And so we typically see Alexandrium start to bloom after the water temperature has approached about 10 degrees Celsius. And I can't think of what that is in Fahrenheit.
That's like 10, I think, is approaching 50.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I was going to say 51. So once the temperatures start to warm up, in Alaska, Southeast Alaska, in the early spring, and once it gets to about 51, is typically when we start to see blooms of Alexandrium. And it's thought that temperatures below about 8 degrees Celsius, Alexandrium can't grow. It's inhibitive, to their growth. One of the interesting issues, though, is that we're starting to see the average sea surface temperatures increase. And in fact, over the last 50 years, I think the average sea surface temperature in Southeast Alaska has increased by about half of a degree Celsius. And so what's a possibility, and kind of what other people have projected, is that over the next couple decades, we might start to see these harmful algae might be blooming earlier in the year, and they might be able to bloom later in the year as well, because the acceptable temperature range for them is no longer, maybe late April into early October, but it might extend from late March into early November. And sort of as case in point of that, people often say, don't harvest shellfish in months that don't have an R. And so that typically leaves you with the summer months of May, June, July, August. And so it's said if you harvest shellfish, make sure the month has an R. And so that would be, September through April, all those months have an R. So they all should be good for harvesting shellfish. However, since we started the cedar monitoring program, we've seen blooms of toxic algae. We've seen shellfish. The blue mussels go hot in March in Ketchikan. And then in November of last year, we had a really large bloom in Prince of Wales. And so the shellfish were – the blue mussels went toxic in Klawak in November. And so – it may be that as we see the sea surface temperatures start to warm, it may be that the season, the available bloom window for Alexandrium is actually kind of increasing. We might start to see blooms earlier and later in the year.
Well, so that, I mean, I guess I would have naively thought that light was playing a larger factor, but if they were blooming in November, then, I mean, that's already getting pretty, I mean, it's not the darkest time of year, but it's not a lot of daylight that time of year, and what daylight there is pretty low angle. So that would suggest that they don't necessarily need a lot of daylight to bloom.
Yeah, they're probably more temperature limited than they are light limited. We have not very much light in November. It's even starting to get pretty dark now in mid-October. And by November, there's certainly not that much light. But if the water temperatures are high enough, you can still get a bloom of phytoplankton, even with only 8 hours or 10 hours of daylight.
And I guess it would also would, I mean, they're presumably even in the summertime, the light intensity attenuates pretty quickly as you go down into the water column. And so I don't know how deep these things are actually effectively able to photosynthesize, but maybe, I mean, presumably it becomes a shallower bloom in the wintertime just due to that factor. But I guess it would make sense that they can make use of relatively limited light to maximize kind of the amount of space that they can use in the water column. I guess that would make sense. I hadn't really thought about that before, but these algae they're blooming. And actually, one of the things I was curious about, and I forgot to mention on the talk, I'll just kind of describe it. And I don't know if you have an explanation for this or anything, but I noticed on the Stargavin, so that's I think one of a couple of sampling sites that they're routinely monitoring here in Sitka area. If you looked at the full line, it started out relatively high, dropped, and then kind of had this overall trend upward since that. I think within the first, I don't know, I can't remember what the horizontal scale was, but within the first few months, it was relatively high, dropped, and then has been trending upward since then with the spikes in the middle when those blooms occur. Is there any reason why, and this would have all been mussels presumably, why there would be this kind of overall trend happening over a couple of years? Like, do you have a sense of why that might be?
I don't know that there is an overall trend that I've seen in the data. Sometimes when you look at things, when you have spikes and concentrations as high as we've seen in Sitka up into the several thousands, sometimes it can be difficult to look at concentrations, right, and establish trends of really low concentrations of things. There is a little bit of the assay that they do at the Sitka tribe is called the receptor binding assay, or the RBA assay, and there is a little bit of error around their estimate of concentration. It's a perfectly great assay, and it's saves you from having to kill a bunch of mice. But a concentration of 70 is statistically probably not that different from a concentration of 65. And so I try not to look too closely at concentrations that are below that 80 threshold, and make too many inferences based on that. I wouldn't say that there are any sort of overall trends, in PSP values that I can deduce yet from what I've seen in the data.
Yeah, and I mean, I only noticed it when you put the smooth line on there, so it could be an artifact of that kind of smoothing that was happening as well. I just thought it was kind of interesting because it wasn't like, I mean, it started out relatively high and then took a bit of a drop and then was kind of looking like it was ramping up slowly. So I didn't know if there's any sort of non-artifact of the data reason that might occur. So you mentioned the line there of 80, that's 80 micrograms per gram?
Per 100 grams of shellfish. Grams. Yeah.
So micrograms is 1/1000th of a gram. Is that right?
Yeah.
So it's weird to have 80 micrograms and 100 gram per 100 grams. So the units there are a little fussy, but I'm trying to move zeros in my head to figure out. It's a fraction of a percent, essentially.
Yeah, and the reason that they do that is they sort of they tried to make the threshold interpretable in terms of a serving of shellfish, which the FDA estimates to be about 100 grams.
All right, so it's kind of 80 micrograms per serving. More or less, and that is the threshold set by the FDA for safe consumption, with some wiggle room based on factors like size. Basically, how big a person is matters, I guess maybe people it affects people slightly differently, but generally below 80 is considered safe for folks to eat.
That's right. Yeah, and the FDA threshold is it's based on a lot of good science, looking at sort of like dose response curves, where they've injected the toxins into some study species and determined sort of what the lethal dose is, but it's actually the threshold is kind of set for everybody, but there certainly is an effect. If you were somebody who weighed 300 pounds, the dose of PSP that it would take in order for you to feel symptoms would be more than somebody who weighed 150 pounds, because there is a weight dependent response there. The FDA sets the threshold at 80 micrograms per 100 grams for everybody.
And so below that, presumably, the you wouldn't expect to have any symptoms. Above that, your symptoms are going to depend on how far above and how large you are, essentially. And then your body's uniqueness, however it metabolizes things.
Sure. And then another big one is how many shellfish you eat.
Right.
We've seen and we've heard of cases in Alaska of people getting sick from just eating one shellfish. The shellfish can have concentrations. We saw concentrations up to 8,000 in Juneau this year. So, it could be as dangerous as just eating one shellfish, and you might start to experience symptoms. We don't necessarily know, and the FDA doesn't pretend to know how many shellfish somebody's going to eat in one particular sitting. So somebody might eat one oyster, and somebody might eat, 50 oysters. And so they try to set the threshold pretty low, in so that they can sort of take into account those sorts of variabilities.
I see. So yeah, that is I guess that is a rate there. It's per serving, but yeah, if somebody in principle ate 10 servings of shellfish, that it isn't like it's diluted through that process. They're ingesting that all in one. And I don't know how fast it metabolizes through. So like if you ate it for 10 servings over 5 days, that maybe is okay. Relative, like, do you have a sense of how fast that metabolizes through? Or
I don't. I do know that that after consuming the toxin, you can start to feel symptoms very quickly. Some people report, tingling of the lips and tongue within a few minutes of consuming toxic shellfish. Some people it takes an hour or two, but I'm not sure about the metabolism rates in people.
Yeah, I guess so. If people, you know, you describe the symptoms, the tingling, and that's the first symptom. The longer term, the issues are that when it affects your muscles' ability to function, and it's your breathing muscles, then you suffocate basically. So presumably, treatment is like putting on a ventilator until the body clears the.
Yeah, and so it's pretty critical that if somebody is experiencing symptoms of PSP that they get to a hospital, because putting them on a ventilator is pretty important if they do start to have difficulty breathing. But it's interesting that in a lot of communities that I visit and I talk to people about eating shellfish and harvesting shellfish, that a lot of people, you know, will tell me that they've experienced tingling of the lips and tongue, you know, after eating some shellfish. But, you know, they didn't seek medical treatment or they didn't go to a hospital. And so we suspect that the DHHS, Department of Health and Human Services, keeps track of how many PSP cases we've seen in Alaska. And over the last about 45 years, it's been about 250 cases. But people suspect it's actually higher than that. We think that it's an underreported phenomena because, people will experience symptoms just like tingling of the lips or tingling of the tongue and just kind of not seek medical treatment either because they don't want to or they're not in a position where they're able to do that. They're in a remote community on a beach somewhere out far afield. And so they don't seek medical treatment. And so, you know, of the 250 cases that DHHS has reported, it's possible that it's even higher than that of cases of PSP.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I guess, you know, going back to that, you said that the peak value you measured this past summer, and maybe that's over the whole time they've been monitoring, was 8,000 micrograms per, so that's 8 grams per 100 grams. So like 8% was, if I'm doing my math right there.
So it'd be... 8 grams per 100 grams.
Or micrograms a millionth.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's 1 × 10⁶.
Right. Milligrams would be 1,000. Right. Okay. Right. That makes me ask, like 8% sounds awfully high.
Yeah.
Milligrams. Yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be 1,000. So a million. So it's basically 8 milligrams per 100 grams at that point.
Yeah. I think that math checks out.
Yeah. Yeah. Metric system. Too many zeros.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's a substantial dose in one. That's in a single collection of muscles, I guess, was probably what that was.
Yeah. And we've been monitoring with the CEDAR group just for a few years now. The Department of Environmental Conservation, or DEC, also does some monitoring here in Alaska. They work mostly with commercial shellfish operations. So if you've had, you know, oysters from any grow operations here in Alaska, they're required to send their shellfish in for testing before they go to market. And so any oyster that you've had, that batch has been tested by the DEC for PSP. The DEC has actually measured higher concentrations even in areas in Northern Lynn Canal and Haynes and Skagway. I think they saw concentrations of like 17,000 in a blue mussel sample up in Haynes. I believe that was 2014. So yeah, the concentrations can get really, really high, especially in these like blue mussels, which are really, really active feeders.
Yeah. So, you know, you were mentioning the lethal dose, and I've only, you know, my background is math and statistics, and one of the things that I ran across in statistics but didn't do a lot of work in was some of the toxicology stuff where you're looking at LD50s, I guess, which was the lethal dose to 50% I guess they're usually using mice or something and they inject them and they say, what is the dose that makes for 50% death or something like that? Is that kind of, I'm just curious a little bit how that works in general, you know, like when you're, cause your background is a more general environmental toxicology, if I understand it.
That's right. Yeah.
And so like, what is it that, we are exposed to sort of reports of things being toxic or not toxic, you know, all the time. And plenty of natural things are toxic. I mean, the paralytic shellfish poison is an example of that. But like, what are the sorts of things that we should be thinking about or considering as we are hearing these reports and trying to make sense of the numbers that we're getting?
Yeah, I mean, I think an important thing is to look at the FDA threshold. If the if the numbers come back and they're above 80, you know, the recommendation is to not eat any of those shellfish. But I think one of the important things that we're doing with this monitoring program, especially the fact that we're monitoring year round, is we want people to feel safe harvesting and collecting shellfish when the concentrations are low. And so we do our best to put out, advisories when the concentrations are elevated during the spring, summer, and fall. But we also put up the data when we get concentrations back that are below 80. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game, their policy is that shellfish harvesting is never safe. But, you know, for me personally, if I can, you know, speak on my own behalf, I feel very confident going out and harvesting shellfish a day after we harvest the shellfish and they come back not under 80 micrograms per 100 grams in Juneau. We want people to be looking at the website and kind of using those data to help inform their own decision making when they go out and harvest. But yeah, the LD50 is it's the dose that is lethal to 50% of a population, and there's some interesting reasons for why they do that. One is that it's kind of tricky to report the LD100. Right. You don't necessarily ever know what the dose is that will kill 100% of the population. The LD50 for shellfish, I don't actually know it off the top of my head, and I'm sure it's nobody's ever figured it out in people, but they've probably done some mice and rat studies. It's a good metric for environmental toxicology to sort of assess a concentration that you don't want to be anywhere near.
Right.
I should be clear that the LD50 for PSP in shellfish is way above 80.
Right.
80 is sort of the threshold for whether the FDA considers it perfectly safe for consumption.
Right. I guess where I've seen LD50s kind of more generally is like in comparison of the like what is the most toxic snake in the world, you know, that
sure.
sort of thing. It's like, yeah. Well, this much venom will kill, 50% of the people, which is not real comforting, when your life is a coin flip, essentially, whether you live or die. Of course, you want something to be much, much lower than that.
Right.
But it is, I guess it's worth noting that the concentration does matter. Like there are plenty of things that your body can process just fine as long as
absolutely.
It's in small enough concentration. And so there is no really having no toxins whatsoever. Like we're ingesting toxins and phytotoxins from our vegetables, that they have things to deter grazing. But we process those. And in some cases, it seems as though our bodies use those somehow to help themselves.
Yeah.
But I don't fully understand all that. It like goes over out of my depth pretty quickly. So, but I do find it kind of interesting, and it is. It's just, it's hard to know. It's hard to understand and interpret sometimes what we see. Because a lot of it depends on presentation as well. Sometimes,
sure.
Sometimes people like to clickbait or whatever it is in the modern time, these dangerous things. Or maybe they are dangerous and maybe they're not. And it would be helpful, I think. I don't know if you know of any resources for sort of making sense of like toxicology, environment, and understanding how to interpret the things that we're seeing reported on. That might be helpful.
Yeah, I think one of the things that immediately comes to mind is the issue of mercury in the environment. And a lot of people there's a lot of misinformation, a lot of confusion about mercury, especially in the foods that we eat. Here in Southeast Alaska, everybody eats fish, or most people eat fish. Some people are surprised to find out that there's mercury in fish. And they sort of make the assumption that any mercury is bad, and that you shouldn't eat fish because it has mercury in it. It is true that some people, should not consume, certain types of fish, with certain frequencies. The FDA again has a, or I'm sorry, the EPA has a really handy tool for looking at fish and making decisions about which fish you should buy and which fish you should eat with what frequency, kind of based on the amount of mercury that those fish typically have in them. And so they kind of label the fish as either, you know, unlimited, you know, just go for it. These fish are perfectly fine to kind of, you know, once or twice a week. And then there's fish that, you know, you should eat sparingly. Because they do typically have high mercury concentrations. But people see kind of mercury and they see these concentrations in fish and they kind of assume that, you know, it's the humanity's fault and we're putting mercury into our fish. And mercury's been around forever. It's a naturally occurring element. It's produced by volcanic activity. So volcanoes spew it out. Hydrothermal vents spew it out. It can be sourced from the erosion of rocks and minerals in the mountains. And mercury have been in fish for as long as there have been fish. So there are definitely some fish that do exhibit really high concentrations. Usually those are like top predator fish, things like tuna or sailfish or pike. Some of those will have particularly high concentrations. And there are some groups of people that should, you know, be conscious of how much and how often they're consuming those species. But the EPA has a really good calculator for sort of, especially if you're eating a lot of fish, and especially for sensitive groups, like women who are pregnant or think they might become pregnant. The tool is a really good resource for looking at kind of what's the average concentration of the mercury in particular fish species and how often I can eat them.
Yeah, so that is one that I've heard about. That seems like tuna fish, especially you get, you know, hear about somebody eating tuna for every meal and eventually getting sick and finding out that they had too much mercury, essentially.
Yeah.
It's an interesting topic. I'm sure that there's a lot of work. I know that you mentioned to me that your graduate work was looking at you know, environmental toxins and how it showed up in other animals in trying to understand the implications for human health. Like you were going to school in Fairbanks.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they have issues with, and I've heard about this, read about it, the air quality due to inversions and people not necessarily burning wood very cleanly. And maybe they're burning other stuff besides wood as well. I don't know. But that the air quality in Fairbanks can be really, really bad in the wintertime, and that has toxic effects on animals.
That's right, yeah. So Fairbanks, we kind of sit in the bottom of this big valley, the Tanana Valley, and we get very cold air temperatures during the winter, but occasionally what can happen is we get a very dense or a very cold air that kind of sits in the valley, and then there's this lens of warm air that sits on top of it. It's known as an inversion because normally, you know, warmer air sits closer to the surface, and then the higher up you go in the atmosphere, the colder you get. But this is an inversion because the cold air is sitting down low and there's warm air sitting on top of it. And the air is just perfectly still. There's really no wind during an inversion. That's kind of one of the features of an inversion, is everything just kind of sits still. The air is just perfectly stagnant. And so any emissions or any combustion you do and you throw up particles into the air, it's just going to kind of sit there. And so in the wintertime, we get something that people call ice fog, which is, you know, a nice way of saying it's just smog and particles from wood burning stove and the coal power plant.
I suppose cars are contributing.
Exactly. Yeah. Automobile exhaust and diesel exhaust are all part of it. And we can get really elevated levels of particulate matter. And one of the ones that we're monitoring is particulate matter that's 2.5 microns or less. It's called PM2.5. And it can be, a big irritant, and it can be especially impactful for people that have, you know, pre-existing lung conditions. Elderly people or people with asthma tend to, they get really irritated by the PM2.5.
Is that because it gets deep into the lungs relatively easy?
Yeah, so it can penetrate into kind of the smallest corners of your lungs, and it can exacerbate, you know, asthmatic conditions, or people can have difficulty breathing. And even more than that, in recent years, it's been linked to all sorts of long-term health effects. So, you know, they've examined populations of people living in very densely and very commonly polluted cities like Beijing and in China. The PM2.5 concentrations there are often very high, and they've linked that to these long-term health effects. And so it was interesting to sort of look at that. It's very difficult to do kind of off the cuff biomedical studies with humans. You need a lot of permission, which is good. It's good that we have these systems in place, but you need to check a lot of boxes and talk to a lot of people. And it's pretty easy. It's not perfectly easy, but it's much easier to work with animals. You can design studies and programs that are approved by the International Use and Care of Animals, messing up the acronym, the IUCUC committee, and they can approve a study. And so we designed a study where instead of looking at humans, we were going to look at sled dogs. There's a lot of sled dogs in Alaska, especially in Fairbanks. And they have a couple of nice qualities that make them really good study subjects. One is that they live outside, so they're continually exposed to outside air conditions. Humans have this nasty habit of going inside in the wintertime, and so that kind of messes up our exposure to certain PM2.5 concentrations. Sled dogs are also fed the exact same diet for the most part, so we can have 30 subjects that are all eating the same thing. They typically don't have the same vices that people have. They don't smoke, they don't drink. And so we can rule those things out, of their histories. And they often have the same exercise regimen. The teams are often run roughly the same amount, every day. And so they actually make pretty ideal, study subjects. And so we did a study where we took blood samples, and we looked at gene expression, which is kind of a biomarker for if the animal's cells were being stressed or not. And we looked at the stress levels kind of before and after a really strong inversion event. And we didn't see anything conclusive. So we didn't see a huge spike in the gene expression for any of the particular genes that we were interested in. But we do think that it's an interesting method for assessing health risks of PM2.5, and we're promoting it as a great biomedical model.
Yeah. So I guess the hope there would be in part to, I guess longer term, maybe some of those things are more longer term rather than acute issues. And I don't know, like some things, you know, a single spike isn't that big of a deal. You know, your body will flush it out, and it's not it's not great, but it's not that big of a deal. There might be a short term effect, and I suppose longer term studies, looking at that over time would start to get at. And I guess if you have comparisons of animals that aren't in that bowl, and aren't exposed to that, you can do something like that. Which, starts to sound like it takes a little while to start to see. What's going on in the bigger picture.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, there's some of these environmental toxins. You know, we were talking about PSP, which has a very rapid response. It can be minutes to hours before you start to see symptoms. But there are other contaminants that we have in the environment where the effects might be more chronic, or it might be a longer term exposure that's required in order for you to see any sort of symptoms whatsoever. So PM2.5 might be one of those. Things like mercury and lead also have chronic effects.
Right. I guess lead, if you lick a lead weight, it's not really going to be that big of a deal. But if you lick a lead weight every day, it's probably not great.
Yeah, it's chronic lead exposure is definitely a problem. And parts of the country are having to deal with that right now. Although I do, the acute lead exposure and acute lead toxicity is also very dangerous. You wouldn't get it from licking a fishing weight or something like that.
But like people that do their own reloading
and, yes,
you know, melting lead for...
Yeah, reloading definitely exposes you to high concentrations of lead. Usually cases of, you know, acute lead toxicity, they are associated with people doing industrial operations with lead, and they end up inhaling a lot of it that's aerosolized or something like that. But the symptoms have been described as kind of one of the most terrifying things.
Oh, no.
You kind of just like... have these nightmare hallucinations, your brain is just fritzing out. Try not to get exposed to huge concentrations of lead.
I'll take that under advisement. Yeah. Well, it is interesting how, you know, different things, you know, some things, it doesn't matter if you get a little bit PSP, you know, it doesn't matter if your cumulative exposure over many years could be really high, as long as it's never very much higher. You know, not above the level that it causes a problem in the moment. And you know, getting back to your overall project, your dream is to be able to create this model prediction system, essentially, that would say, okay, we've looked at the conditions. Here's the forecast for the next 3 to 7 days. It's probably a bad time. And I suppose that's the biggest thing. It's like, these are times that look especially not great for. And you know, given the variability of from bay to bay, you know, it can be pretty different as to what's blooming. It's hard to make a region-wide, you know, it's definitely a problem here, but more like it's a high chance that there's an outbreak somewhere. And so be extra careful kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we, you know, there's other areas of the state, of the country that have these operational forecasts for PSP. And they're usually, you know, these extremely complex models that involve, you know, currents and hydrodynamic models for an area. And they can do point-specific forecasts for a region. I was just reading about a system that's going in Florida where they can actually see blooms happening via satellite, and based on prevailing wind current and current conditions, they can kind of predict where it's going to show up on particular beaches. We don't have anything nearly that fancy, and also our satellites often don't penetrate the layer of clouds that happens to be sitting over Southeast Alaska right now. Hopefully we can come up with something where we can, you know, we can kind of identify the conditions that lead to these blooms, and we can make predictions about when and where they're going to happen, and just sort of get that information out there so that people can make safer decisions when it comes to collecting shellfish.
Yeah, and I guess one last thing. We've talked about the concentration makes the difference here, and that in the water, though, there's no way that you can get enough toxin in the water for it to be an issue for humans. You did mention that there are some blue-green algae, cyanobacteria in freshwater systems in some places that are actually, it sounds like they create enough toxin to actually be, toxic to animals, people swimming in those waters. And I've heard people on Facebook, you know, responding to the coccolithophore blooms were like, don't let your dogs go in there. I don't think coccolithophores are an issue for dogs if I understand it right. But maybe this is kind of like third hand from these experiences you were speaking of these other kind of organisms that are creating toxins that are actually concentrated enough when they're blooming.
Yeah, there are cyanobacteria that the blooms can be a huge problem in reservoirs for drinking water. This is something that's happening all over the mainland United States, and they can be at concentrations where actually just drinking the water can cause symptoms and even death. There's other toxins that are produced by phytoplankton that can be harmful if you happen to be swimming in the water. Off the coast of Florida, they have one called brevetoxin, which is produced by Carina brevis. And that one is not necessarily deadly, but it can be just a lung and eye irritant if you're swimming in the water. And so they'll issue warnings for beaches, telling you to stay away from those beaches while they're having a bloom. PSP is not one that we know of that, you know, you can accumulate enough of the toxin just by swallowing the water or swimming in the water that it would be a problem. I'm not encouraging anybody to swallow
seawater. Yeah. It has its own issues. Yeah.
Yeah. I would stay away from that if you can. The reason that it exists in high concentrations in things like shellfish is just because they're filtering a ton of that water, up to, 50 gallons a day for blue mussels. So if you happen to drink 50 gallons of seawater, you probably have other problems.
Right. Yeah. For sure. Well, I appreciate you coming in. Is there anything else you'd like to mention before we wrap up here?
No. Thank you. Thank you for interviewing me. I had a great time.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded with John Harley this past week. He is with the Alaska Coastal Rainforest Center in Juneau and has been collaborating with CTOR, the Southeast Alaska Tribal Ocean Research Laboratory, looking at ways to try and model when conditions might be ripe for a harmful algal bloom. So I want to thank him for taking some time out of his trip to visit with me. And thank you for joining me here this week on the Sitka Nature Show. As always, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. Until next time, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW, Sitka.